It's time for the Des Moines Register on Monday, April 8. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Nicole Tam. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer Voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather, across the state today it should be pleasant with clouds and sun. Winds west-southwest 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tuesday, intervals of clouds and sun. Winds west-northwest 8 to 16 miles per hour. And the central Iowa forecast for the next few days looks like this. Today, a high of 68, a low of 42. Pleasant with intervals of clouds and sunshine. Winds west-southwest 10 to 20 miles per hour. Partly cloudy this evening. Winds northwest 6 to 12 miles per hour. On Tuesday, clouds and sun with a high of 64 and a low of 42. On Wednesday, mostly cloudy, high 67, low 44. And on Thursday, Wednesday with clouds and sun, and a high of 59 and a low of 40. Tracking precipitation in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Saturday, we had zero precipitation. Our month to date has been 33 hundredths of an inch against a normal of 61 hundredths of an inch. Our year to date has been 5 4/100 of an inch against a normal of 5 26/100 of an inch. Last year, on this date, we had had 5.7 inches of precipitation. Sunrise today, it was at 6:45 a.m., and after what could be a fairly substantial view of a partial eclipse this afternoon, the sun will return and set at 7:48 p.m. On moonrise today is at 6:42 a.m., moon set today, 8:06 p.m. Turning now to the front page of the Des Moines Register, I will tell you that it is completely taken up with a big headline and a big picture. And the headline reads, Clark's Final Bow. The picture shows Caitlin Clark, Iowa number 22, surrounded by her teammates on the gym floor. Not the gym floor. I'm sure it's not a gymnasium, but the arena floor in Cleveland. The picture is subtitled, Iowa Women Deliver a Remarkable Season, although they fall short in the title game. And as I said, the picture shows Caitlin Clark and her University of Iowa women's basketball teammates huddling up during Sunday's NCAA tournament championship game in Cleveland. The Hawkeyes lost 87-75 to top-seeded South Carolina, ending Clark's phenomenal career in an Iowa uniform. The West Des Moines native rewrote the NCAA record book during her 4 years with the Hawkeyes, and her team finishes as a two-time NCAA runner-up. We will have what I am sure is lots more coverage of that game in the sports section during the second shift this morning. Turning now to local headlines, engineering company plans a Riverside office, plans okayed for Target anchored Waukee Town Center, and a man held a job for 30 years on a stolen ID. Now here with the first story is Nicole.
We'll start with that engineering company plans Riverside office. The Des Moines Urban Design Review Board approves $6 million facility. This is from Addison Lathers for the Des Moines Register. An engineering firm got a good deal on a city-owned riverfront property last month. Now it's submitted plans for the vacant parcel. What does it have in mind? LT Leon Associates Incorporation is looking to expand with the 8,208-square-foot office building at 1805 Ohio Street. The property is in Des Moines Central Place Industrial Park, an area north of downtown in the Riverbend neighborhood. As first reported by Axios, it's located across the Roy's and the Des Moines Rowing Club and on the route of the planned Central Place Levee Trail. The city's Urban Design Review Board approved plans on Tuesday that include office space as well as conference rooms and warehouse storage. The firm currently is housed in a one-story office building just to the north at 1823 Ohio Street, which it will remain after the relocation, bringing the properties with an expanded parking lot. LT Leon President Louise Louise Leon says the building also will feature a rooftop deck to give employees a break area with the views of the Des Moines River and the downtown skyline. Leon's submittal did not include a timeline for construction. The project is estimated to cost $6 million, and it is not being considered for financial incentives. The city already agreed to sell LT Leon Associates the 36,560-square-foot parcel for $15,000 in early March. The Polk County Assessor values that land for the firm's smaller neighboring property at $43,300. The purchase agreement calls for the new building to meet sustainability criteria. The firm has also decided to build 90% of the exterior with renewable materials, use geothermal heat pumps, and also implement an intensive storm water management plan. LT Associates has taken on several municipal projects since the company's founding in 2009. Some of its work includes technical assistance for the Icon Water Trails master plan and designing a launch area for the Raccoon River in the Waterworks Park that will feature a boat ramp accommodating both paddlers and powerboats. There's also a large image of that building, the 1805 space, that's at the new spot. And that is it for this story.
Thanks, Nicole. Plans okayed for Target-anchored Waukee Town Center. Development is moving forward at Waukee Town Center, anchored by Target, with the City Council having approved plans for a second phase. Target broke ground in May 2023 to be the 148,000-square-foot anchor tenant at the planned 62-acre, $132 million shopping center in Waukee, southwest of the intersection of Hickman and Southeast Alice's Road. The complex also is planned to have an array of other retailers, green space, and an 8-acre lake, access to the Raccoon River Trail, a playground, an amphitheater, and an ice skating rink. Waukee City Council on April 1 unanimously approved a site plan for the southwest section of the property that will include the skating rink, amphitheater, playground, and lakeside buildings. But the plans do not include the exact details of any buildings, which will need later approval, and only allow workers to move forward on utility infrastructure and parking lots. Mike Pearson, co-owner of development company Pearson Companies with his son Nick Pearson, said in a statement that many of the planned tenants in the complex will be new to the Des Moines market and Iowa and would include apparel, home furnishings, beauty, and fitness, as well as food and beverage and entertainment offerings. That's a quote from Mr. Pearson. Pearson said he could not share more details or opening dates, including the anticipated opening date for Target, but expected there would be tenant announcements by late summer. He did say the area that just had its site plan approved would include lakeside restaurants. Restaurants also will be located on lots along Southeast Alice's Road, Pearson said. Plans for the lot include buildings with a combined more than 116,000 square feet of space, according to city documents. He added that construction of the features, such as the amphitheater and skating rink, would take place at the same time as the retail and restaurant buildings.
This next story is from William Morris of the Des Moines Register. A man held job for 30 years on a stolen ID. The victim is jailed and put in the mental hospital. A longtime University of Iowa hospital worker was not who his colleagues believed he was. From 2013 to 2023, William David Woods worked as a systems architect for the hospital's information technology department. In fact, though, the man working for the hospital at an annual salary of more than $140,000 by the end of his tenure, officials say, was an entirely different person, Matthew David Currens. The real William Woods, living in California, not only was a victim of a decades-long identity theft scam, but was criminally charged and committed to a mental health facility for trying to convince authorities he was who he said he was, according to federal prosecutors. Currens, 58 years old, was finally caught after a University of Iowa police detective investigated the real Woods' persistent claims. On April 1st, Kearns, a suburban Milwaukee resident who had been working remotely, pleaded guilty to federal charges of identity theft and lying to a credit union and faces a likely years-long prison sentence. The twisting and turning saga, first reported by the Cedar Rapids Gazette, is laid out in court filings and press statements from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa. Among the revelations, the real Woods spent 2 years in jail or court-ordered treatment after pleading no contest to identity theft, with Kearns egging on the prosecution as he admitted in Monday's plea filing. Woods could not be reached for comment. Kearns, born in 1966, was raised in California by adoptive parents. Woods, whose real middle name is Donald, was born in Kentucky in 1968. The two met around 1988 while they both worked at a hot dog stand in Albuquerque, New Mexico, according to those court filings. Starting as early as 1990, Kearns began using Woods' identity as his own, obtaining a fraudulent Colorado identification card and bank statement thereafter. After buying a car with bad checks in 1991, he then moved on to Idaho. In 1994, he got married under Woods' name and has a child in Oregon, whose last name is also Woods. So in 2012, Kearns was able to fraudulently obtain a copy of Woods' Kentucky birth certificate using information from Ancestry.com. In 2013, Kearns, by then a resident of Wisconsin, was then hired by the University Hospital, where he continued working remotely for the next decade. Now, over that time, he earned more than $700,000, all based on fraudulent identification documents in Woods' name, prosecutors say. Kearns' plea agreement describes him as the key administrator of critical systems, whose access to the hospital's computer infrastructure was the highest that it could be. A hospital representative told the Gazette that Kearns was not a senior leader in the organization. Kearns also used Woods' name and identity to open bank accounts and take out auto and personal loans from two credit unions that totaled to about $250,000 between 2014 and 2022. In 2019, the real Woods, who was homeless and living in Los Angeles, learned that somebody was using his identity and approached a national bank branch for help closing the accounts that Kearns had opened there. Woods had his authentic Social Security card and state ID card, but could not answer security questions for the account. Police and officials contacted Kearns, who answered the security questions, and said that he had not given anyone in California permission to access the account, leading LAPD to arrest Woods for a felony identity theft. He was then ordered held without bail. Officials had at least one clue that something was amiss. One document that Kearns faxed to prove his identity had Woods' real middle name, Donald, instead of his assumed middle name, named David. In a follow-up phone call, Kearns told investigators that he sometimes go by the middle name of David, but his name is William Donald Woods. Woods remains incarcerated, and his defense attorney told the court that she doubted his mental capacity or competency. In 2020, a California judge ordered Woods sent to a state mental hospital for treatment, including with psychotropic days in jail and 147 days in a mental hospital. Woods pleaded no contest to two felony charges and was then sentenced to the time served. He was released with the order that he only use his true name, Matthew Kearns, going forward. Kearns remained deeply involved throughout this prosecution. He admitted in his plea repeatedly contacting prosecutors for updates and also voicing concerns about the delays. After Woods was released, he continued trying to reclaim his identity, leading Kearns to add additional false police reports about his actions. Woods eventually learned where Kearns was working and in January of 2023, contacted the hospital's security department to complain about him. Officials there then referred the complaint to the University of Iowa Police Detective Ian Mallory, according to those court filings. Mallory then interviewed Kearns, who repeated his story that somebody in California had been trying for 4 years to steal his identity. But unlike his California counterparts, Mallory was able to confirm the real Woods story. He contacted Woods' father, still living in Kentucky, and then ordered a DNA test that proved that Woods was his father's son. After that test, Mallory interviewed Kearns once again, during which Kearns mixed up the names of his adoptive father and Woods' father. And when Mallory then confronted him with the DNA evidence, Kearns reportedly said, "My life is over and everything is gone," and then confessed to the entire scheme. Kieran's sentencing has not yet been scheduled. His attorney did not immediately respond to a message seeking for comment. This is the most bizarre thing ever.
That is really strange. 30 years, huh? Wow. Well, that concludes the stories from our front page section of the Register. We're going to move down to Metro in Iowa. Trans lawmaker speaks at a youth event. Iowa Safe Schools' annual LGBTQ youth event took place Friday, welcoming more than 800 students, educators, and families from across the state to Meadow Events and Conference Center in Altoona. The event fell just days after the 15th anniversary of Varnum v. Bryan, a 2009 Iowa Supreme Court case, which led to the legalization of the same-sex marriage and Trans Visibility Day. Since 2005, the all-day affair known as the Governor's Conference on LGBTQ Youth serves. It serves as a way to celebrate and empower students as well as equip them and other allies with various resources, workshops, and activities. It's about creating a safe space for young people, community members, and advocates to show their pride and learn how to better support their communities, said Damian Thomas, Director of External Affairs at Iowa Safe Schools, the largest organization in the Midwest serving LGBTQ youth. From making zines to buttons to learning, I believe zines are online magazines, aren't they? From making zines and buttons to learning about mental health services, the conference was lined with members of nonprofit, medical, faith, and higher education organizations ready to answer questions and share information. Their tables were piled with handouts, business cards, and other items, such as pride bracelets, pins, and condoms. It's really a holistic event targeted toward every issue or concern or something that an LGBTQ student in Iowa might have on their mind, Thompson said. Thompson and Iowa Safe Schools Executive Director Becky Taylor led fireside-like chats with keynote speakers Mercury Stardust and Montana State Representative Zoe Zephyr. Here's a rundown of the event. First, Stardust and Zephyr build careers on speaking up. Stardust and Zephyr traded personal stories and advice with Iowa Safe Schools' Damian Thomas and Becky Taylor on the center's stage. For about an hour, Stardust and Zephyr, whose appearances bookended the event, spoke candidly about how they became the people they are today. Stardust is a Wisconsin native, Zephyr from Montana. Stardust is a TikTok star who rose to prominence for her home repair tutorials. Zephyr is Montana's first openly transgender lawmaker who made national headlines last May after being barred from speaking on the chamber floor. Zephyr had told opponents of legislation on banning gender-affirming care that they would have blood on their hands. It turns out that sort of marriage of prayer and guilt did not go over well, she said to Thompson and to the crowd. Zephyr, in conversation with Thompson, recalled difficult moments about the incident, as well as opened up about what it means to her to be a lawmaker. Representation obviously matters, she said. And I know it sounds like an easy catchphrase to say, but really, it changes the way we have the conversation. Stardust also shared with audience members the purpose of her social media platform. I'm famous because I wanted to help somebody online, and I helped somebody, she said, adding she built her platform on that mission alone and came away with a large following, or rather a community. I didn't get famous because I was really good at putting lipstick on or really good at dancing, and there's nothing wrong with those things, she continued. That's wonderful. That's beautiful, right? But really, do we ever have there's something wrong with the way this sentence is printed. Let me see if I can figure it out here. She says, but rarely do we have, but rarely do we ever have the opportunity for purity of like just being radical and queer. And it just happens to be someone who can fix that something. And that was Stardust talking. Second, youth say the event makes them feel seen and less alone. Peter McCann woke up at 5 a.m. Friday morning just to get ready for the conference. McCann, a senior at Roosevelt High School, said he promised his peers he would attend the event in drag. The 18-year-old took more than 2 hours to complete his look, which he says drew inspiration from his love of horror films, cartoons, and 90s icon Winona Ryder, and his work paid off. Students from other schools approached McCann throughout the day to compliment him on his attire, their face lighting up as he turned to thank them. McCann's brightly colored spiky hair, sparkly corset, and neon yellow tulle skirt stood out against his striped orange and black sweater and long black skirt. Growing up, I just always, to the best of my ability, dressed like this and liked horror, he said. His makeup, almost reminiscent of the character Sally from the animated movie Nightmare Before Christmas. Now that I'm older and I have the ability to do it, is pretty straightforward trajectory, he said. McCann, who is transgender, said he's attended the conference since middle school and has looked forward to it ever since. Over the years, the teen has met new people and made new friends. The conference, he said, has often reminded him that queer people exist in his home state. Landon Hoadley, a 13-year-old from John Adams Middle School, and Janisha White, a 15-year-old from Hoover High School, shared similar sentiments. Hoadley, who is transgender and uses they-them pronouns, arrived to the event with the transgender pride flag and pansexual pride flag pinned behind their ears. Hoadley, who attended the event last year, said they enjoyed seeing people like ourselves come together and share their experiences. As White made her way through the conference lobby, she told the Des Moines Register she felt immense support by just being at the event. White and her girlfriend, Bessie Clemens, were both new to the event and visited several tables, grabbing pamphlets and free giveaways. The couple said they each have had trouble coming out to friends and family and feared being judged. White said she found the conference to be beautiful, while Clemens pointed to the resources she thought were helpful. They also said coming to the event together and hearing Stardust open up about her own experience made them feel less isolated. "I'm not alone," White said. And finally, safe spaces in Iowa. Bailey Stone, co-founder of the I Am Me Project, was among the dozens of local leaders who attended the event. At her table, Stone sprayed streaks of temporary blue and purple dye on strands of teens' hair while sharing details on an upcoming event for trans and non-binary students. The I Am Me Project is comprised of several hairstylists from the Des Moines Metro, eager to teach others how to make their salons welcoming for LGBTQ customers. Asking pronouns and providing gender-neutral bathrooms are just some of the ways, Stone said. A haircut is a very important part of the gender-affirming process and coming out in general, said Stone, whose organization will be offering free haircuts for trans and non-binary students on April 7 and 8. Those interested are encouraged to book an appointment at IAMMEIOWA.com. That is the abbreviation, although it's not the abbreviation, it is IAMMEIOWA.com. Across the lobby, Julie Swiftbird was spreading the word about Tanager Place's LGBTQ Youth Center. Swiftbird, who goes to Metro High School, said she was 12 years old when she first went to the youth center, and she says her experience has changed her life. She said she's become more confident and found lasting friendships. At Tanager, she said young people can come and hang out. There they can knit or play Dungeons and Dragons. Other than that, she said they can also learn about mental health services or health education or partake in financial literacy classes.
This next story is very interesting. Can GPS help snowplows in Lane? There's a large image of a snowplow with tons of snow on the ground and a beautiful Des Moines skyline in the back of that. Iowa State researcher says this gear could be saving lives. This is from Paris Barraza of the Des Moines Register. A snowplow driver's view out of their windshield during falling snow is at times akin to when the Millennium Falcon goes into hyperdrive in Star Wars. In the movie, the view outside of the spacecraft distorts, white stars stretching towards you and obscuring the dark space as the craft travels. At least that's how Rusto Martin described it. He's the garage operations assistant with the Iowa Department of Transportation's Grinnell, Malcolm, and Tama maintenance garages. He said, you feel like it's hitting you in the forehead. You're out there and you're like, man, I hope I'm where I need to be. Snowplow drivers are usually pretty close to where they need to be, Martin said, but it's still difficult. After all, the roadways are completely covered in snow, and you can't see the painted road markings. These are the challenges that snowplow drivers face, but Martin and Iowa State University researchers have been working on one solution to aid those drivers in the form of lane assistance technology, which would show drivers where they are on the road and also alert them if they start to drift on the roadways. This could be a total game changer where you know exactly where you are in that lane, Martin said. This technology will warn snowplow drivers via a display if they drift a little too far to the right or left off a roadway, Martin explained. Drivers will also be able to see an image of their vehicle and its location on the roadway. Think of the vehicles that show drivers a bird's eye view of their car and surrounding areas on display as they park, or the side view mirrors that will light up to indicate a car is in your blind zone to avoid those potential collisions. The concept and purpose are similar to what is being developed for snowplows. But a snowplow won't use a camera like some cars. Blowing snow would only obscure that view. So instead, vehicles will be relying on a highly accurate map of the roadway and GPS technology to track their location. This is from Anj Sharma, an Iowa State University professor and co-leader of Real-Time Analytics of Transportation Data, or Reactor Lab. He says lives can be saved in two ways. One is that we can keep the road clean and then the other vehicles don't get into any crashes. But also the drivers who are driving these snowplows, you can just think about their level of stress that they're under when they're driving in whiteout conditions. They don't even see the lane marking. Sharma added that there might be times when snowplow drivers are disoriented and can cross lanes, traveling in the wrong direction of traffic. Conversations about using this kind of technology go far back, Martin recalled, who had been part of research committees for the Iowa DOT for years. If farmers were utilizing GPS for tractors, why not in snow vehicles to aid drivers in zero visibility conditions, Martin said of colleagues' questions years ago. He was later tasked with writing a research proposal and was then awarded grant money to pursue what is now the lane guidance and technology with Sharma and his team over at Iowa State. A different form of lane guidance had been used in at least several snowplows in Alaska as of 2019. This is according to the trade media service Heavy Duty Trucking. Sharma says that they have been approached by drivers of emergency vehicles who are interested in this technology since they also drive in severe weather and low visibility conditions. The technology for lane departure and showing drivers where they are in a lane had been fully developed and is being tested, Sharma says. Currently, the team has two tests taking places, but only one uses a snowplow. The technology had been installed in one Iowa DOT snowplow truck in Tama and in an SUV at Iowa State in Ames, Martin and Sharma said. Another part of this project to detect objects and avoid collisions on roadways is still being developed and tested on just the Ames vehicle. So the when is time to funding as far as when will more Iowa snowplows get this lane guidance technology. Since showing snowplow drivers their location on roadways does require generating a map of that area, statewide usage of this technology means the need to generate statewide maps. Map generation for all the freeways and roads maintained by the Iowa DOT would require a one-time investment of $500,000 to $600,000, Sharma estimated. The team is also exploring options to combine already available data from snowplow vehicles and from the Iowa DOT to generate these high-resolution maps needed. And then there's the cost to actually install the hardware of this technology into a snowplow, a cost that Sharma is hoping to keep below $15,000 per vehicle. The team is also seeking different funding sources to deploy this in additional vehicles over the next few years. Now, before this story ends, I just want to describe a couple of images that accompanies this article. The device itself, this technology, kind of looks like TV cable boxes in a way. There's an image here of that equipment for lane guidance assistance that's installed onto the truck. And finally, a GPS unit. There's an image of that. Just looks like a little... Actually, it looks like a pencil sharpener, but just glued to the vehicle and the back of the vehicle and the truck bed, it seems. That is a GPS unit that's attached to a snowplow, and that is how that lane guidance is used, rely on that little device there. So between two little boxes, seems like the technology is helping out drivers.
Sounds like a good deal to me. Video screens fill aisles at Hy-Vee. Hy-Vee's new business-to-business advertising subsidiary is debuting with the installation of video screens, airing advertisements in most aisles of some of its larger Des Moines metro stores. Hy-Vee launched the new venture called Red Media in September, saying it would allow other companies to reach its customers through various Hy-Vee platforms, including advertising in Hy-Vee stores. Initially, most advertisements on the screen last week were internal promotions for Hy-Vee services and products. The one encouraging consumers to visit pharmacists to get vaccines carried a logo for pharmaceutical company Pfizer. Hy-Vee did not say how many stores have the new screens. A Des Moines Register reporter saw them at West Des Moines stores at 1725 Jordan Creek Parkway and 1700 Valley West Drive and the Waukee store at 1005 Hickman Road. The West Des Moines-based chain has long tested new products and ideas at Central Iowa stores before rolling them out across the more than 240 stores in its 8-state chain. Cincinnati-based supermarket giant Kroger has established a similar advertising and marketing division as grocers try to leverage data they gather about their customers and take advantage of the captive audience of shoppers in the stores. Grocery industry analysts have praised Red Media as a significant new means by which Hy-Vee can reach consumers and generate new revenues. Hy-Vee spokesperson Tina Potthoff said Hy-Vee has always used its stores to advertise deals, values, and new product services, but in the past it has reached customers through paper tags or printed signage, she said. She went on to say that customers will now see us start utilizing digital technology via screens in our stores to help tell the story behind a product, provide more details about a saving, or deal or promote a new initiative. Hy-Vee announced in late March that it had hired Jessica Hendricks as its chief marketing officer and that she would lead Red Media. The University of Iowa graduate formerly served as the CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi 10, the business-to-business marketing division of the French advertising firm Publicis Groupe. Anna Sturmeyer, formerly Hy-Vee's chief marketing officer, will become the chain's chief merchandising officer, according to the news release. At some stores, including its Grimes location, the Des Moines Metro's largest, Hy-Vee has digital price tags on shelves that allow it to update prices quickly. The new screens in stores will allow it to update advertisements in a similar way, Potthoff said. The screens also allow messages to be specific to a market and can be updated in a timely fashion.
Now, two short stories before we move back to the main section of the Des Moines Register. Perry schools can be paying bonuses to employees after shooting. This is from Stephen Gruber Miller of the Des Moines Register. Perry schools will be able to provide retention bonuses to staff members and will see some graduation requirements waived after Governor Reynolds signed a law on Friday in response to a shooting earlier this year at the district's high school. The January 4th shooting at Perry High School shook the community after a high school student fatally shot 11-year-old Amir Joliffe and principal Dan Marburger. They also wounded six other people before dying of a self-inflicted gunshot. Reynolds said this in a statement on Friday announcing the bill signing. As the Perry Community School District continues to heal, this legislation will provide students, teachers, and staff with an additional layer of support, allowing them the flexibility that they need to care for themselves and for each other. We stand with Perry and are committed to doing whatever we can to help that community recover. House File 2653 allows the Perry Community School District to use up to $700,000 from its existing district management levy funds to pay retention bonuses to school employees for the upcoming school year. It also waives certain state requirements for the amount of instruction time that the district must offer and assessments that the students must take to graduate. The district suspended classes for several weeks after that shooting. The law did pass with bipartisan support. Representative Carter Norman, a Republican from Panora, said when the House passed the bill last month, by allowing these bonuses, it is Perry's hope that they can mitigate losing teachers and staff over the next year. And the final story in the Metro and Iowa section, an Ankeny teacher accused of abusing a student no longer works for the district. This is from Chris Higgins of the Des Moines Register. An Ankeny teacher and coach accused in February of sexually abusing a former student is no longer an employee of that district. Rachel Whiteside, a former middle school teacher at Northview Middle School and district softball coach, was charged on February 21st in Polk County's district court with sexual abuse, exploitation by a school employee, and lascivious conduct with a minor. The charges center on allegations that Whiteside had an inappropriate relationship with the student that started in 2015 and it continued for several years. Whiteside had previously been placed on administrative leave. A district spokesperson did confirm that she is no longer an employee with that district. Whiteside's charges remain pending in court, and arraignment is scheduled for April 11th, according to online court documents. At its April 1st meeting, the Ankeny School Board rejected a personnel report with Whiteside's resignation. However, after a closed hearing, the board did approve the superintendent's recommendation to terminate the contract of a teacher whose name was not disclosed. A district spokesperson confirmed on April 4th that Whiteside was no longer employed with the district, but couldn't say whether hers was the contract that the board voted to terminate. Iowa law calls for a teacher whose contract might be terminated to receive notice and the right to request a private hearing that is not subject to open records law.
And that does conclude the stories in the Metro and Iowa section. We'll return now to the front page section and some national news. The judge and prosecutor are at odds in a documents case. The prosecutor and judge in former President Donald Trump's classified documents case just can't get along. Even when U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, sided with Justice Department Special, even when U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon sided with Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith on Thursday and rejected Trump's bid to dismiss the charges for hoarding classified documents, Cannon and Smith seemed at odds. The Trump-appointed judge described a related request from Smith as what she called unprecedented and unjust, and she tartly noted Smith is free to appeal her decisions if he does not like them. Smith has threatened to have a federal appeals court review Cannon's proposed jury instructions for a trial for being wrong and too favorable to Trump. The dispute represents at least the fourth conflict between the prosecutor and the judge in the high-profile case, with two reversals of Cannon rulings already from the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Legal experts say Smith might have to ask the appeals court to review Cannon's proposed jury instructions because they favored Trump's position in the case. An even more provocative step would be for Smith to try to remove Cannon from the case, a rare move that some legal experts say is justified. Changing judges could postpone the trial until after the November election. Trump faces 40 charges of retaining national defense documents and concealing about 100 records with classified markings at his Mar-a-Lago resort after leaving the White House. He has pleaded not guilty. The latest showdown focuses on the Presidential's Records Act, a statute adopted after Watergate that designates nearly all of a president's documents government property to be stored at the National Archives after an administration ends. Exceptions are made for personal records such as birthday cards. Trump contends he converted the classified records to personal documents before leaving the White House in 2021, so any dispute should be handled in civil court under the Presidential Records Act rather than through criminal charges. Trump had previously claimed, without evidence, that the documents discovered at Mar-a-Lago by the FBI were potentially planted there by government agents. Prosecutors say the Presidential Records Act has nothing to do with the case and charged him with 32 counts of what the charge called willfully retaining and failing to deliver national defense documents in violation of the Espionage Act. Cannon, on Thursday, refused to dismiss the charges, make no reference to the Presidential Records Act, nor do they rely on that statute for purposes of stating an offense. That's the end of the quote from the ruling. The lingering dispute over the Presidential Records Act is that Cannon asked prosecutors and defense lawyers to weigh in on two possible jury instructions for the trial. Both of Cannon's proposals echo Trump's position, with one saying courts and juries cannot review a president's decision to categorize administrative records as personal. Smith has asked Cannon to rule promptly on her view about the Presidential Records Act, which she did. But she refused to finalize the jury instructions before Trump's defense presents its case at trial. To finalize jury instructions before the defense presentation would be what she called unprecedented and unjust. In reference to the jury instructions, Cannon replied in her Thursday order that, quote, any party remains free to avail itself of whatever appellate options it sees fit to invoke, end quote. Some legal experts said Smith should ask the appeals court to review Cannon's lack of ruling on the jury instructions. Neil Katyal, a former acting U.S. Solicitor General, said Smith has no choice but to ask the appeals court to review her proposed jury instructions. Katyal wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter, Judge Cannon just rejected Trump's bogus Presidential Records Act defense, but only for now. I think Smith has no choice but to go to the 11th Circuit to ask for a review. Joyce Van White, a former U.S. attorney, suggested the best strategy for Smith might be to ask Cannon to withdraw from the case because she is what White called straight off the rails. The normal rules do not seem to apply, she wrote on X. Another conflict erupted between Smith and Cannon when she ordered on February 6 the public release of names of witnesses in the case as Trump requested. Cannon rejected government requests to redact names of witnesses along with statements they made to the FBI or grand jury from documents filed publicly in the case. But Smith argued February 8 that releasing the names publicly could expose witnesses to threats and harassment, as has happened in other Trump cases. Judges issued gag orders against commenting on witnesses in Trump's New York civil case, the New York criminal case, and the federal elections interference case in Washington, D.C. The judge in the civil case, Arthur Engoron, received a bomb threat at his home. The judge in other federal cases, Tanya Chutkan, received death threats. There is a well-documented pattern in which judges, agents, prosecutors, and witnesses involved in cases involving Trump have been subject to threats, harassment, and intimidation, prosecutors wrote. The dispute remains unresolved. So far, Cannon has not released the names publicly. Legal experts say Smith could appeal any move to unseal witness names.
Next, Johnson may need Dems to save job, faces ouster threat when the House returns. House Speaker Mike Johnson rode to power on the wings of the ultra-right coalition in the Republican Party, but now he faces a revolt from one of the most conservative members of his caucus, and the very thing that made him vulnerable, a willingness to work with Democrats on spending legislation, could be what saves him. When the House of Representatives returns from a two-week recess on Tuesday, Johnson will face the move to oust him by one of the same starchy conservative lawmakers who embraced him just months ago. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, took the first step in trying to remove Johnson from his job last month. She filed what's known as a motion to vacate, which would forcibly eject Johnson from the speakership shortly before lawmakers left Washington for recess. Greene did not try to force a vote on the floor, but instead, she left it as a warning for the speaker. Greene's grievances with Johnson escalated after the House passed a $1.2 trillion bill to fund the government's long term. The deal failed to win support from the majority of Republicans, who object to the bill's total spending levels and lack of stricter policy changes to address the border crisis. But unlike his predecessor, former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, who Democrats allowed a right-wing faction to topple without intervention on his behalf, the opposition party could swoop in to rescue Johnson from a potential ouster vote. This is according to some House Democrats. In recent days, Green has ramped up her criticism of Johnson and has questioned his ability to lead conservatives since taking the gavel. She says Mike Johnson has completely changed his character in a matter of about 5 months after he became Speaker of the House. Green told conservative interviewer Tucker Carlson last week he called himself a conservative, always has been, but yet here we are. She added Johnson has made a complete departure of who he is and what he stands for. Johnson's tactic to rely on Democrats to fund the government closely mirrors McCarthy's decision to avert a government shutdown with the help of Democrats. In response, a handful of right-wing rebels, Green not included, ousted McCarthy along with all House Democrats. Johnson's conundrum comes from a key concession McCarthy made to his right flank last year when, during his bid for speakership, he agreed to change House rules to allow just a single member to call a vote to remove the speaker. Green told CNN last week that her effort to oust the speaker has gained momentum, but so far, no other Republicans have publicly come out in support of removing Johnson. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican from Florida, who led the ouster of McCarthy, has claimed that some Republicans would elevate House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, as the Democrat from New York, as speaker if Johnson is ousted. But should Johnson deliver on bipartisan priorities such as Ukraine aid, Democrats could vote to save Johnson instead. Representative Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, told Fox News on Sunday last week that he would consider saving Johnson if the House passes aid to Ukraine along with funding to rebuild the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. Ukraine aid has been a long sticking point in the House. Johnson has faced intense pressure from both sides of the aisle to pass continued aid of the embattled nation. But an increasing number of members in his conference have expressed skepticism about further assistance. A House Democrat told USA Today on the condition of anonymity to speak candidly that Jeffries and Democrats shouldn't lend Johnson their support for free, arguing the GOP's razor-thin majority gives them leverage over the speaker. Let's see. The lawmaker said, "I think we might vote to save him, but we're at that point now where Democrats should get something in exchange. The narrow majority definitely strengthens Hakeem's hand. But if Johnson were to be saved by Democrats to keep his job, it would rile up more conservatives." Green has already called Johnson a Democrat Speaker of the House because there is zero daylight between Nancy Pelosi did last Congress and what Mike Johnson is doing now as our so-called Republican Speaker of the House. Green has heavily rallied against Ukraine aid, and should Johnson put it up for a vote, it could be the tipping point for Green to force an ouster vote. Johnson has promised lawmakers that the House will vote on Ukraine aid in the near future. If Johnson is ousted, it's not clear who his successor would be. After McCarthy's removal, it quickly became evident the handful of conservative rebels did not have an alternative speaker ready to be back. As a result, House Republicans were engulfed and bitter in fighting and went through three other speaker candidates before settling on Johnson. The dysfunction while Republicans scrambled to elect a new speaker revealed the deep fractures that run through the House GOP conference. During those 3 weeks, Republicans laminated that the chaos reflects poorly on their image to voters headed into the 2024 elections. It's also unclear if Republicans would be willing to endure another tumultuous speaker fight that would again display the division of the House Republicans as the election draws near. Let's see who said. Johnson described Green as a, quote, friend last week on Fox News and said he was also frustrated with the government funding deal, but he argued that with the narrow majority in the House, he says, we're sometimes going to get the legislation that we don't like.
The Small Business Administration could boost aid for Native American firms. This is a story out of Phoenix, Arizona. Tribal business owners and entrepreneurs may soon gain more support for accessing services from the Small Business Administration, usually referred to as the SBA, if a bill overwhelmingly approved by the House passes the Senate. The Native American Entrepreneurial Opportunity Act, co-sponsored by Representatives Eli Crane, a Republican of Arizona, and Sharice Davids, a Democrat of Kansas, would require the agency to establish an Office of Native American Affairs to support small businesses and entrepreneurs in Indian Country and provide more support to Native Hawaiian organizations. The bill passed the House on a 402-16 vote. A report published by the Federal Reserve shows why Native businesses need the extra support. The report says that in 2022, the nation's central bank found that fewer than 1% of business owners are indigenous, although American Indians and Alaska Natives account for about 2% of the U.S. population. In addition to the new SBA office, the bill calls for the agency to develop relationships with tribes and tribal organizations and direct entrepreneurial development, contracting, and capital access programs to tribal communities. The office would also be added to the existing Small Business Act, which requires annual reporting to Congress. A statement by Crane's office said the move would ensure oversight of the new Tribal Affairs Office. Crane, who represents more than half of Arizona tribes, said that although tribal entrepreneurs should have the ability to access SBA's program, they do not have adequate access or outreach. It's essential that they receive specialized expertise to assist them in navigating the unique complexities of running a business on a reservation, complexities mostly created by the federal government, he said. David said the economy depends on small business access, success. On small business success. That's especially true in tribal communities where Native-owned businesses are crucial employers on reservations and their surrounding areas, she said. Dave Castillo, CEO of Native Community Capital, which provides financial and technical assistance to tribes and individual tribal members, said he is concerned that the office has only a 7-year term and has little, if any, funding to implement it. Whereas there seems to be unlimited funds for bank bailouts and subsidies for big industry, Indian country is left with either poverty programs or access to programs that were designed without tribes in mind, he said. But Robert J. Miller, a law professor at Arizona State University and a nationally acknowledged expert in tribal economic development, said the bill looks like an excellent step. He said, "I have advocated for over 20 years that private sector development in Indian country is the most important issue Indian reservations, Native communities, and tribal nations face."
The FDA okays cell therapies for treating earlier stages of type of blood cancer. The Food and Drug Administration has allowed for cell therapies of Johnson & Johnson and Bristol-Myers Squibb to be used for treating patients in the earlier stages of a type of blood cancer, the company said on Friday. Both J&J and Bristol-Myers therapies have helped extend the time that patients lived without disease progression in the late-stage studies, more than when the patients receives, quote, standard of care treatments, the company says in separate statements. The agency's decision comes after an expert panel backed the use of therapies. J&J's, I don't know how to pronounce that. I think it's Carvykil. It's a treatment spelled C-A-R-V-Y-K-T-I. And Bristol's Myers Abecma last month in less severely affected patients with multiple myeloma. Guggenheim analyst Kelsey Goodwin estimated that the expanded use would add about 12,000 patients who will be eligible to use Abecma. Goodwin estimated that peak U.S. sales of about $450 million from Abecma for Bristol-Myers partner 270 Bio. The other drug, the CARVYKTI drug, on the other hand, could bring in as many as $7.6 billion in global peak sales for J&J and its partner Legend Biotech. I'm sorry, this story has a lot of medical terms that I'm butchering a little bit. But anyway, Abecma and that other drug belong to a class of treatments that's known as chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapies that work by modifying white blood cells known as T-cells to attack cancer. The current standard of care treatments do include the use of non-CAR-T therapies in less severely impacted patients. Approved medications for the condition does include J&J's Darzalex and generic cancer drugs such as pomalidomide, and also bortezomib. Okay, anyway, the last line here is CAR T therapies have recently come under some scrutiny from health regulators. I am so sorry about all those readings of those complicated terms.
Well, I'm glad it was you and not me trying to navigate that story. Excuse me. Excuse me. Following the eclipse, three more reasons to look up in April. Few celestial events have managed to capture the public's collective attention and inspire such a widespread sense of awe as... Well, this story's a little bit old because it says next week's total solar eclipse, but that solar eclipse is happening today. Come Monday, today, the 115-mile-wide eclipse will move from the southwest in Mexico to northeast in Canada. In the United States, 13 states fall in the pathway of totality, where the moon will completely block the sun's disk, leading to a period of darkness. Considering both the rarity and the sheer grandeur of the cosmic display, the first in North America in 7 years and the last for 2 decades, it is no wonder even non-astronomers are excited. But amid the clamor to watch as the moon passes in front of the sun and ushers in a dazzling sight across the continent, it may be easy to overlook some other celestial events in April that are also worthy of our admiration. When the eclipse has come and gone, sky gazers will have other reasons to look up, and here are three of them. On April 21, the so-called Devil Comet. While the famed Devil Comet may be visible during the solar eclipse itself, astronomers say that the celestial body will be best sighted on April 21st. That's the day that the comet, officially and prosaically known as 12P/Pons-Brooks, no wonder they call it the Devil Comet, that kind of hard to say, will make its closest approach to the sun in its 71-year orbit. The Devil Comet earned its demonic nickname from its distinctive tail that resembles horns. It is typically visible to only those with the strongest of telescopes, but on the day it is closest to the sun, its brightness should increase so much that it will become visible by the naked eye. On April 21 and 22, Lyrid's meteor shower. The Lyrids, one of the oldest known meteor showers on record, has reliably peaked in late April like clockwork for thousands of years. The shower, pieces of debris from the also prosaically named comet C/1861 GI Thatcher, is one of 4 major meteor showers each year that have a sharp peak. This year, that peak falls between April 21 and 22, according to EarthSky.org. The first meteor shower of the spring, the fast and bright meteors of the Lyrids, will appear to be flying across the night sky. While NASA notes that the Lyrids can surprise watchers with as many as 100 meteors seen per hour, in general, 10 to 20 Lyrid meteors can be seen per hour during the peak. And on April 23, the pink moon. The pink moon, otherwise known as the first full moon of the spring, will rise on April 23. The moon will not appear quite as pink to our eyes here on Earth as its namesake, the moss pink wildflower, sometimes called the creeping phlox, that sprouts this time of year, but that will not make it any less spectacular to witnesses. As it rises just above the horizon, the pink moon will appear its biggest and take on a golden hue, according to the Old Farmer's Almanac.
And now we'll take a look at some 50 state highlights and short stories before we get to birthdays. The highlight today is out of Florida. There's a large image of a person in a beekeeping outfit, and then looks like what appears to be a law enforcement official also in a bee outfit. That's because in Tallahassee, inmates at the Leon County Detention Facility are now getting to see the fruits of their labor, or more precisely, the honey of their labor. The Leon County Sheriff's Office Ecology and Reentry Training Hub Haven has 4 active beehives that inmates take care of with the hopes of a harvest of honey and beeswax. The program started about a year ago, and March 28th was the first harvest of the program. Sergeant Daniel Whaley showed 2 inmates how to remove the bees from their hives with smoke and to check if the combs had honey. The 6-month program prepares the incarcerated for the workforce once they're released. Another quick story. Okay. The Des Moines, Iowa one is a story we already read. It's the one about the GPS technology with the Iowa DOT and Iowa State, so we're going to skip that. And taking a look at other Midwest areas, Springfield, Illinois. One of the first homes architect, Frank Lloyd Wright, designed in the prairie style, is now up for sale. This is the first time the Warren Hickox home, built in the 1900s, had been on the market since 1976. And looks like it's time for birthdays.